This is Greater LA KCRW show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Federal agents arrested LA City Councilman Jose Huizar earlier this week on racketeering charges. Here's United States Attorney Nick Hanna.
The case lays out a sordid tale of how Mr. Huizar and his cronies sold themselves to the highest bidder, and in so doing, sold out the residents of this city.
Huizar is accused of taking hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash and gifts from real estate developers in exchange for getting their projects approved by the city of L.A. And we're not talking little apartment buildings here. They are big developments with big money behind them. A 35-story tower in the Arts District, for example, or a 77-story skyscraper backed by a Chinese billionaire. Well, a decade ago, the parts of downtown L.A. with these mega projects were not in Huizar's district. But in 2012, the city's council districts were redrawn, a process that happens every 10 years. That's when Huizar became the representative for most of downtown L.A., and that laid the groundwork for the scandal that's unfolding today. KCRW reporter Anna Scott is here to take a look back at how it all unfolded. Anna, welcome.
Hi, Steve.
The transfer of most of downtown into Huizar's district was pretty controversial, even if we're going back 8, 9, 10 years ago, right?
Yeah. This was a fight. Now, you know, back then I was a reporter for the Downtown News, a local paper here in L.A. that covered this. So, you know, these parts of downtown had been part of the 9th district, which was represented at the time by Jan Perry, and her district also included South L.A. And she was good at using the economic development of downtown L.A. to benefit the poor communities in her district, and she didn't want to lose that connection. And the other important thing here to know is the dynamics of the city council at the time. Herb Wesson, who is still on the council, was council president then. Was very close to Jose Huizar. They were best friends, as he put it at one point. They both had appointees on the redistricting commission. The redistricting was a very politicized process. Jan Perry, along with Bernard Parks, who was on the council at the time, were at odds with Wesson. They didn't support his election to council president, which, if you follow the city council, you know, is kind of a no-no. The city council, even now, they rarely oppose each other publicly or even have a non-unanimous vote. So all of that was going on at the city council. And with the redistricting, Jan Perry said then and says now that reshaping her district the way they did was also a form of political payback. We talked on the phone this week.
The people in South Los Angeles had their source of revenue flowing from downtown going south cut off from them because of the desire to wield power in a way that meets out punishments and rewards to other elected officials.
Mm. Rewards. All right. Well, Herb Wesson is still on the city council, by the way. He was, as you mentioned, the president at the time. What does he have to say about all this?
Well, I put in a request this week on this issue specifically and didn't hear back. But, you know, I've talked to people who were involved in the redistricting process at the time and looked back at old news stories from then. And, you know, one thing I will say is that redistricting, it is like a jigsaw puzzle. There are many considerations. There are laws that need to be followed. It's based on census data, so they have to try to balance out the populations of the various districts. So Jan Perry's district, because of that, needed to shrink. Jose Huizar's district needed to grow, could only grow in so many directions. And you could make some of the same economic arguments that Jan Perry makes about South LA, about some other areas around downtown that were already in Huizar's district, like Boyle Heights, Pico Union, for example.
Yeah, depending upon which direction you go. By the way, we should say that some of Huizar's constituents say he is a good representative. He's tried to work in affordable housing into the district to make streets safer, to name a couple of things. But of course, all in hindsight, with these large developments now at the center of the corruption allegations, putting this downtown area in Huizar's district doesn't look so good, I guess.
Well, yeah, of course, in hindsight, it doesn't. And we don't, you know, we can't watch the sliding doors movie of what would have happened if this redistricting hadn't played out the way it did. I did speak this week to a political consultant who's worked around City Hall for a long time, who ran campaigns actually challenging Huizar on City Council. And he said that around 2011, as part of one of those campaigns, in doing opposition research, he interviewed some former staffers in Huizar's office who he says told him about smaller scale corruption that was going on in the office and that the redistricting enabled what Huizar is accused of now. That consultant's name is Eric Hakopian. Here he is.
Well, what was going on in 2011 that we learned from his former staffers was a much smaller scale. It involved shaking down businesses and 7-Elevens and dry cleaners and things of that nature for much smaller amounts of money, 2,000 here, 5,000 there. What happened is that after the redistricting process, all of this corruption became industrial scale because there's a big difference between what small businesses can give you and what you can get out of foreign development interests.
Anna, I mean, why look back on all of this right now, though? What's the value in this?
Well, look, you know, none of this happened in a vacuum. You know, there's a long history to everything that we're seeing unfold today at City Hall. And also the census process is going on now. They do this redistricting every decade. So that's going to be coming up again, and it'll be something to pay attention to.
Well, we certainly will pay attention to it, the census and all, and this corruption scandal as well. KCRW's Anna Scott reporting from downtown L.A. Anna, thanks.
Thank you.
And back now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiatakis. On the heels of many Black Lives Matter protests, one editor and production executive in Hollywood was getting flooded with requests to find black editors. So he took to Facebook to post in a group that has roughly 14,000 members, hoping to fulfill the requests. He wrote, quote, "Looking for black union editors, please DM me your contact info." Well, the ensuing responses, some of which were eye-opening, have put yet another spotlight on Hollywood and its lack of diversity, certainly lack of diversity behind the camera. Ricardo Handy was the author of that Facebook message. He's a film editor and owner of Sunwise Media, and he's here to tell us about the ripple effect of that post, which, by the way, is still going. Ricardo, welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Walk us through what happened. I mean, you posted on Facebook in this large group, thousands of people in this group, in search of black editors. What were the responses that you got?
Well, initially, I got some names, which was great, and some suggestions. And then, you know, inside the chat, there was a lot of back and forth about the legalities and, you know, whether this was, you know, a reverse racism post. And so essentially, inside the chat, there just started to be a lot of tension and people going back and forth, you know, arguing the topic, and it just escalated from there. And some of the posts just got really nasty and just weren't necessary for this conversation.
Did it confirm to you what you've always known?
You know, I think that through my career, I've had a long career, I've had a 25-year career in the business, and I've come across all kind of personalities. And so, you know, much like our country, you know, the opinions are reflected in the industry. So all the opinions are in there, you know, the most liberal, the most conservative. And so it'd be correct to say I've experienced those kind of comments before. I think that in the space that we were in, I was not surprised at some of the comments, but I did feel that they were fighting too hard for that point because it was obvious that it was just a simple, innocent request.
It was an innocent request. You were looking for a contact list, right? Essentially.
Yeah. I mean, throughout my career, I have helped many people find work. I mean, that's this entire business is all based on recommendations, right? It's all about your social circle, who you know. And what happens often, you know, people are looking for, you know, a Spanish speaking editor or a French speaking editor or someone that's familiar with dance culture, right? Or some other type of segment of society. You have experience in this segment of society. I want you to work on my show. And black is not just a color, it's also a culture, right? And so that's part of why people would be looking for this. You know, unfortunately, we have shows like Housewives, right? Some of the Housewives franchise, Atlanta Housewives, and most of the post-production team, if not all, are not people of color. I know there's one black person in post on that show. You know what I mean? So that's one of the reasons why people are looking. It's a conversation that happens often.
I mean, when you're looking at these responses and people are accusing you of reverse racism, which I think, you know, I mean, when you're in a clear minority, I think it's hard to be racist. What's going through your head?
You know, there's a lot of disappointment, honestly, because, you know, like I said before, I work on shows where it's mostly white folks, and those are my friends. One person put in a post, it was like, it was disappointing to see what was in the heart of my, you know, fellow workers, you know, and not all of them, some of them, right? Whoever made those posts. And there was equally on the other side, people that actually knew me in that in that post, defending, you know, my intentions and defending the fact that this is a needed conversation. And so that made me feel a lot better instantly. But in the moment reading it, yeah, I was super disappointed and like just, you know, it's hurtful to find that what's lurking in the back of someone's mind is that I don't deserve to be there, or someone that looks like me doesn't deserve to be in the conversation as much as they do.
You've been working in the industry for a long time, for decades at this point, but I wonder what it was like for you when you were just getting started, you know, as a black man trying to get paying gigs in Hollywood. I mean, what was your experience trying to get work at the beginning? Did you find a lot of hurdles?
Yeah, I mean, over the course of my career, I've had some great opportunities, and I have some opportunities where, you know, maybe I didn't fit. You know, I didn't get the job, and I didn't know why. And you always wonder, why was that? Was it because I don't have the right look or the right background? I do find that, you know, especially even working at the network level, and working even with PR folks and, you know, different people that I work with in that capacity, that they'll get the black account, right? But they won't get the general market account, you know? And that's the same experience you have on the creative side. You know, I might get to, you know, they'll call me to run a show about all African Americans, but they may not call me to run a show where the whole cast is Caucasian. And so I feel like there's a disconnect there because, you know, we all have the ability to tell stories, and we need everyone to help tell these stories. And it can't just all be from one perspective. You know, we all have our perspective, which is ultimately why I started my company. You know, I started my company, Sunwise Media, to create content that I wouldn't be able to, no one would be able to stop me from putting out, no one would be able to kind of be a gatekeeper as to what stories I was allowed to tell, you know, and we just put a film out in May, Help Village. You know, really, it's about everyone. You know, there's black, there's white, there's all different kinds of stories in there about people recovering from addiction. And it's a story told by a black man, but it's about America. It's about our problems with addiction.
What is the Facebook post taught you? I mean, when you're looking back on all this is just a couple of weeks old, you know, what have you learned from this?
It's not even a couple of weeks. It's literally been like 8 days.
8 days.
I posted it last Tuesday, June 16th.
And it's still going, by the way. It's still going, right?
And it's still going. Yeah. It's interesting because I'm seeing the posts that are happening now in that group kind of shift. You know, I've had so many conversations with so many people. I'm working and partnering with the Urban League on some initiatives. I mean, I've kind of been brought into this movement that a lot of people have already been working on. But now, you know, I have a voice, and so I'm trying to help any way I can. And so I just been having a lot of great conversations about people that do want to help, you know, people asking me at different studios or different production companies. And they're asking the question, you know, how can we fix this problem? It's obviously something that we see, but we may not know what the first step is. Right. And so one of the things that I've done since then is, you know, work with having a conversation with Local 700 and the Urban League to try to figure out, you know, what's something that we can do, just, you know, starting with editors, that maybe can be duplicated, you know, in these other areas. So that's what's happening with me now. And I'm hoping to get some more studio partners and network partners to come on board, because, you know, everyone's siloed. You know, on the one hand, you have the union who, you know, doesn't deal with hiring, yet you do have the studios who deal with hiring, but they don't deal with union qualifications. And so, you know, it's about everyone making that effort equally and coming together for solutions.
What do you think happens beyond this? I mean, is this a moment? Is this something that, you know, you think real change can happen from this?
You know, I'm going to tell you that the hard thing about this whole process is that, you know, one, you have people, folks and companies and studios are, you know, don't want to be called out, right? And then you also have, you know, folks that are angry because this has been a problem for years and they've been experiencing it for their entire lives. And so there just needs to be like a really coming together in a lot of these different silos. And so I'm really trying to be someone that is helping and not making it worse and not antagonizing the conversation and allowing people to be, feel free to like, hey, if you don't know how to have that conversation, come talk to me. I can help. You know what I mean? Or if you need help finding the words, maybe there's a conversation that we can have before you talk to your team or something like that. I don't know. That's kind of what I've been dealing with, because a lot of people want to have these conversations, but they just don't know how to, you know, they don't know where to start.
We certainly love to follow up and see how things are going, because I know it's touchy out there. I have a lot of friends in the filmmaker industry, and they talk about it too.
Yeah, I just hope everybody can, like, you know, understand that this is just a moment where this is being, you know, really highlighted. And if we do something, you know, it can be a conversation that can really shift. But if it doesn't shift, if nothing happens, you know, that's where the disappointment and anger builds up, because, you know, it's not a new conversation, you know. And so we have to really just make some effort to do something and not just talk about it, you know, and that's how things change.
Ricardo Handy, an editor, producer, production executive, and owner of Sunwise Media. Ricardo, thanks for telling us your story and thanks for coming on.
No problem.
Finally today, if you've lived in L.A. for any length of time, you know who this guy is.
L.A. weather is looking better.
And today in L.A., we can expect
hot.
Cold.
Wind.
You were right, Fritz.
You find better weather on another station, bring it to me, I'll match it.
Fritz Coleman has been providing the weather for TV audiences on Channel 4 for decades.
Fritz said it would be like this.
Over the years, he's told Angelinos on NBC every day that it'll be sunny and 72. Fritz will be just another guy soaking up that sun and not so much caring about making the most accurate forecast. Fritz will no longer tell you, it'll be like this. He'll become, gasp,
well said,
gasp,
sir.
Weather consumer. And Fritz Coleman joins me right now. How are you, sir? Welcome back.
That's the most beautifully my career has ever been described right there.
Weather consumer. Are you ready for that, by the way?
From now on, I get to tell people when they ask me about the weather, look on your phone and leave me alone.
You know, I am one of the, I'm a big fan of The Simpsons.
Oh, there you go.
And one of my favorite memes from the show is the newspaper page that shows Abe Simpson, like, clenching his fist, and the headline reads, "Old Man Yells at Cloud."
That's perfect.
And I think of weather people when like an unexpected system comes in and there's rain when the forecast said there was going to be sunshine. Have you ever yelled at a cloud before?
No, I felt like it, but no. And we have so a few opportunities to forecast rain. When we blow it, it's sad.
Is it one of those things for you where you like take it personally? You go home with your head down?
Well, yes. Being a successful television weatherman is learning how to suffer public humiliation gracefully. You know, because what happens is, you know, you make an honest effort. You don't want to be wrong. But then later on that day, you go to Vons and you've got the flu and you're in your pajama bottoms and somebody comes up and says, "Nice job of the forecast, idiot. You know, my daughter's outdoor wedding was on Saturday and it rained 4.5 inches in Sherman Oaks. Thank you so much." It's you want to be right, but and there's something quaint about not being right, because then people know you're fallible, and that really connects you to them more on a personal level.
We're all imperfect, right? We're all imperfect.
Really?
Yeah.
Exactly.
You came out. You were a radio guy, right?
I did radio for 15 years, and while I was in radio, I began to perform in jazz clubs doing stand-up as the MC, and sort of got addicted to that, and thought, well, I'm going to give it a shot. And back when I was first starting, you had to come to L.A. You had to work at the Comedy Store. That was the place that always got mentioned on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. So I moved out here, and I was working at the Comedy Store in 1982, and one of my friends that worked at Channel 4 brought his boss to see me perform. And I had talked on stage. I had an anecdote about I worked for Armed Forces Radio and Television when I was in the Navy, and I was forced to do the weather against my will. And they didn't care that I didn't know anything about it. They just wanted me to fill the time. And so my boss that resonated with my boss. He said, because, you know, there's no weather out here. I just need a weatherman to fill time, essentially. You'll be the palate cleanser between the tragedy and the sports. And so, do you have any desire to come and do it at Channel 4? And I said, oh, my God, I was making $45 a night doing stand-up. When do you want me to start? And I had to audition for him, and I did weekends for 2 years, and then I was bumped up, and I've been there ever since.
Well, I mean, 39, couldn't you make it to 40?
Well, everybody says that, but it's just a number. What am I going to have, a plaque in my den that he made it to 40? It's just, no. First of all, our business has changed so much. Our business meaning the business of weather forecasting. Because of climate change and because of the competitive nature of news, there are three times as many television stations doing newscasts now as when I started. And everything is very serious. And the shortened American attention span, they're not looking for personality in the evening newscast as much as they used to be. I was hired because there's the same weather forecast from April to October. They just wanted somebody to come on there and keep people from tuning out, just be light and fun and interact with the anchor people. I was a comic. But now, because of the number of stations doing weather, and because there's slightly more of a concentration on science, because of climate change and all those things, you can't even get a job doing the weather without the AMS seal, the American Meteorological Society seal. You have to have a Bachelor of Science in meteorology or atmospheric sciences, or you don't get the gig. So I couldn't even have the job now. So it's just different. It's a different time. And it's time. It's time for me to go. I'm old. I don't want to be standing in the green screen with a walker. So I'm saying adios at precisely the right moment.
Well, if you painted the walker green, then maybe it wouldn't, that's right. It wouldn't show, right?
And I'd just be leaning over for no apparent reason. Well, the thing about, and I want to make one thing perfectly clear, if you'll amuse me for a second.
Of
this
course.
Has nothing to do with COVID, and it has nothing to do with the Me Too movement. This has been in the works for a year. I simply extended beyond my contract because I told them I would stay through the worst part of the pandemic, and things are starting to loosen up. So then I said, well, now it's time to go.
It's a long way from the Comedy Store, right?
It really is. And that is the miracle of my career. It's just a different time.
Do you and Dallas Raines, do you occasionally get together and, like, compare Doppler radars? I mean, is there a competition about seven-day forecasts?
There is a competition, but it's sort of at a distance. People would be astonished. I haven't met most of the weathermen in town. I met Dallas because Dallas has been around as long as I have. I think he's been there 40 years. He worked at CNN before that.
Yeah.
And he's a meteorologist, so he can sort of ride this current wave into the sunset if he wants to. I am not a meteorologist. I have a BS degree, but the BS degree I have doesn't mean Bachelor of Science. Mine's in sales a little bit more.
You went to the School of Hard Knocks? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, precisely. I learned on-the-job training.
Yeah.
Coastal eddy, onshore flow.
Yeah.
Santa Ana wind.
What are you going to be doing when you're done?
There are only six or seven recurring weather patterns.
If you're not saying sunny and 72 every day, morning clouds, you know, marine layer, things like that, what are you going to be doing?
Well, I'm still doing stand-up. I do a lot of speaking engagements, lunches and dinners, and I'm also really involved in a number of nonprofit agencies, which honestly has been the most satisfying part of my job, the community outreach work. I always tell people in the personal satisfaction universe, helping smaller and medium-sized nonprofits is much more satisfying than being inaccurate about the weather 4 to 5 days a week. You can put your head down on the pillow at night. I really love that part of my life, and honestly, I expect to be more active in it.
What a time for you, Fritz Coleman, retiring weather forecaster at NBC4. We wish you the best of luck, and we'll continue. I hope you will still come on the show and talk to us about weather. Will you do that for us?
I will talk to you about anything. Keep up the great work. You're a voice of reason down there, my friend.
Thank you, Fritz Coleman. Good luck to you and Godspeed.
Same to you, my friend. Bye-bye.
And we're going to miss you, Fritz. That's going to do it for us today. Next week, statues and memorials are coming down. But some of the most racist structures in America, and yes, here in Greater L.A., are freeways. We're going to look at displacement and separation, apparently by design. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Share your thoughts with us. Tell us how you're doing. And, of course, subscribe to the podcast, too, while you're there at kcrw.com/greaterLA. A lot of hands on the show today. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Mario Diaz, Desmond Taylor, Mario Saavedra, Amy Roken, and Christian Bordahl all made the show happen today. I'm Steve Giotakis. Thank you for your ears and your time. Stay safe and have a great day.